Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold, black gold.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Kathy Bostrom from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Oprah Daily. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. Trips That Transform, A Caregiver's Voyage Towards Self-Care. The Cruise That Helped One Oprah Daily Staffer Reconnect with Herself at Sea, by Holly Carter. A cruise through the islands of French Polynesia. Who wouldn't want to embark on this vacation of dreams? But before I could even think about booking it, the logistics of leaving behind my caregiving duties for my 87-year-old father had me psychosomatically seasick. Being away for what would amount to 2 weeks just felt like an extended luxury I couldn't justify, more like a sabbatical than a vacation. Could my sister step in for more consecutive days than she ever had before? Would the beloved garden I'd just planted survive my absence? Who would watch the house, gather stray packages that slip past the hold mail request? The questions multiplied, as they always do, and I began to wonder. Were these practical concerns, or subtle acts of self-sabotage masquerading as responsibility? The prep and planning felt dizzying. Still, deep down, I knew I had to find a way. As I often remind myself in my journal, if not now, then when? I needed to make good on my motivational mantra. Once a spreadsheet with who could do what when was drafted, the details started coming together, and the possibility began to feel real. This journey of rest and renewal was within reach. I'm not unlike so many of the 17 million people out there taking care of an aging parent. I do it willingly out of love, yet beneath the devotion is an underlying current of reciprocity, like it's my duty to help him after all that he's done for me. My responsibility started after he had triple bypass surgery in April 2017. My mom passed away 6 months prior, so I deferred my grieving and introspection and did what needed to be done. Sometimes I think this dutiful distraction helped me through the loss. First weekend visits, but my dad was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2019, and it gradually progressed, as did his needs. While his mind was sharp, his signature humor intact, and he could still walk, albeit with a shuffle, he'd never cooked dinner anyway, and almost 50 years of marriage to my mother, and could no longer drive. Plus, he was technologically deficient, a flip phone carrier in a smartphone world. So in March 2020, at the start of the pandemic, I essentially moved back into my childhood home in Long Island, keeping my Manhattan apartment as a symbolic tether to a version of myself that was rapidly fading in the rearview mirror. I try to stay in my apartment once a week in order to reset a bit, but this kind of getaway would be a biggie. Letting the waves of a ship rock and recharge me while meeting new people, taking in one of the world's most spectacular landscapes, and eating and drinking to my heart's content was something I craved. So I put my anxiety in the back seat and booked it. An 8-day cruise on Windstar's Star Breeze to Moria, Raiata, Motu Mahia, Bora Bora, and Huaheen. Ironically, I was the last passenger to board in Papeete, Tahiti. I could read into that, but I will chalk it up to a late arrival after visiting another island in French Polynesia. "We've been waiting for you," said Teresa at the activities desk. "No, ma'am," I thought. "I've been waiting for you." Unlike those floating cities with thousands on board, the Sea Breeze was built for human scale and a connection to the sea, with the capacity for 312 guests. I traveled solo intentionally. This was my time to take care of only myself, and as I'd soon learn, to be taken care of by the ship's upbeat and accommodating crew. By the end of the first day, I'd met a handful of fellow travelers, some seasoned cruisers, others on their first great sail, and connections continued at breakfast, the bar, sunsets on deck, and the many excursions. Before boarding, passengers are encouraged to book their excursions. 4x4 adventures, snorkeling safaris, scuba diving, jet skiing, and scenic tours. Everything looked tempting, So I sat with my dad, sister, and 11-year-old niece before I left and explored my options. As a water baby, many of my picks involved snorkeling, including my first in Moria. On a rainy day with limited visibility, some passengers decided to skip it. But I went for it because, as I said to myself, what else am I going to do today? My neighbor on the tender reminded me that the whole point of a cruise is to do nothing. I decided to keep that in mind later when my still jet-lagged self turned in early. It's hard to do nothing when you're used to doing something for someone pretty much every hour of every day, anticipating their needs and sometimes sacrificing your own. But I made sure to infuse nothingness into my itinerary. Taking in the seascape and the beauty of the French Polynesian islands alone felt like an activity in itself. The views so impossibly picturesque that they felt almost unreal. While French Polynesia is made up of 118 islands, a mere 67 are inhabited. After Moria, we stopped in Raiata, which is considered the birthplace of Polynesian culture and the cradle of the Sioux population. French Polynesia is known as the home of the Black Pearl. In Raiata, we took a small boat to a working pearl farm, picture a hut on stilts in the middle of a lagoon, and snorkeled through pearl beds and coral gardens. The next day, I visited Taha'a, which produces another signature export, vanilla, also known as black gold. Like pearls, vanilla requires the most precise of human intervention. Fun fact, a farmer only has a few hours to take the pollen and put it in the stigma of the orchid by hand, which may require him to sleep in the greenhouse. Tahitian vanilla isn't super easy to find stateside, so instead of splurging on a black pearl, I bought every form of it, from pods to powder. Let's just say, upon departure, my carry-on luggage was so heavy and stuffed that I had to check it and gift some sunscreens to the agent. Bora Bora was next up. It's, of course, the most well-known island on our itinerary, a popular vacation and honeymoon destination. While I loved every stop on this cruise for different reasons, my two most memorable days were spent here. During the island tour aboard a colorful open-air bus, we watched pareos being hand-dyed and ate freshly picked grapefruit, way sweeter than what we have stateside, and small, sugary bananas. Then the bus stopped on the road so we could throw flowers out and watch crabs emerge from their holes to devour them, sometimes battling for the same buds. As a nature lover, it was a sight that will stay with me. That evening, Windstar hosted their highlight event, a starlit beach barbecue and fire dancing performance. Head chef Joseph Kalaniuk told me that this experience brought together a tropical vibe with Tahitian culture, which is what the journey was all about. His spread, a tropical riff on paella and freshly caught fish, reflected the bright mix of Polynesian, French, and Chinese influences. I was also impressed by all five restaurants on the ship. With both local dishes and international fare, plus 24-hour room service, it didn't feel churned out for the lowest common denominator like other cruises I'd been on. My last day in Bora Bora may have been my favorite. My final snorkeling expedition brought me face to face with black-tip reef sharks, a friendly sort, stingrays, and rainbow-colored fish. Seeing such an active marine life in close range was thrilling. Our guide, Teroa, sang to us and declared, "I love my job, a joy rarely heard in New York, or anywhere else for that matter," repeatedly as we hopped between snorkeling spots aboard a small boat. Eventually, we arrived at a little motu where we had a delicious lunch of steak, fish, coconut bread, taro, plantain, sweet potatoes, and that super sweet grapefruit again, served on a palm leaf. As we ate on picnic tables in the shallow water, emboldened, hungry fish swam up to our feet. I greeted them with crumbs of coconut bread so they would stick around. The joyful spirit of our guide, the crystalline buzzing waters, and the sheer beauty of that day nearly brought me to tears. I even FaceTimed my dad so he too could witness some of this magnificence firsthand. The cruise ended in Huaheen, a quieter island steeped in culture and legend. It's known as the People's Island, home to sacred blue-eyed eels, ancient ruins, and vanilla plantations. Our guide told us that it was here that scouts came while making Moana to guarantee its authenticity. I'm glad they aimed to get it right, capturing the essence of a place rich in history and pride. It made me step back and realize my own quiet pride, too. Managing caregiving, a home, and a career, with only the latter being something familiar to me, hasn't been easy. Maybe I need to pat myself on the back more. Each day, I try to meet the uncertainty with grace and a smile, reminding myself that caregiving, like everything in life, is temporary. I don't know what tomorrow, next week, or next year will bring, but I do know that life can change in an instant. The trip helped me recommit to staying present, whether that's taking my dad to one of his many doctor's appointments or dangling my feet in the water, watching fish glide by. There's a quiet beauty in both. More than anything, this trip allowed me to take a step back from my own little world, reminding me of my connection to the vast, beautiful world out there, and also see myself in a different light. While in many ways I've become the parent, for these 8 days I took everything in with childlike curiosity and delight. When I returned home, Dad was doing just fine. My sister did a pretty good job, as it turns out, and life carried on. Even my garden persevered. With distance came clarity, and stepping away served as an anchor, steadying me so I could keep steering through any swells life brings my way. Now more than ever, I know I've got this. And that was Trips That Transform, A Caregiver's Voyage Toward Self-Care by Holly Carter. Up next, why do we hang on to objects that hurt us? After her husband of 23 years left without warning, Bea Wilson's heart-shaped wedding cake pan became a symbol she couldn't ignore or get rid of. By Bea Wilson. I have long felt that kitchen objects can have a life of their own. Even so, I found this eerie. One August day in 2020, I was going to fetch clothes out of the washing machine when suddenly a cake tin fell at my feet with a loud clang. It wasn't just any cake tin. It was the heart-shaped tin I had used to bake my own wedding cake. I wouldn't have thought much of it, except that it was only 2 months since my husband had left me, out of the blue. Nearly 23 years ago, this giant metal heart had been brand new. My husband-to-be had told me he liked fruited cake, but hated glacé cherries. For our wedding, I decided to bake him a rich, dark fruit cake with no cherries and chopped-up dried apricots to take their place. There are photos of us cutting the cake together, looking blissfully happy. We would soon be on our way to Venice for our honeymoon. All these years, I kept the tin. We had 3 children, and sometimes I used it to bake their birthday cakes, shiny brown hearts of chocolate cake smothered in ganache. We stored it tucked away on the bottom of a dresser in my hallway, where it was slowly rusting. I kept it there because it was too vast to fit in any of the kitchen cupboards. To give it away would have been unthinkable. It was a keepsake of our love. At the back of my mind, I'd imagined that one day I would use the tin to bake an anniversary cake. In one of her books, the food writer Ruth Reichel gives a recipe for the giant chocolate cake she made to celebrate her husband Michael's birthday the first year that she knew him. A cake so colossal, it took 4 men to help her lift it to the car. Reichel calls it simply Big Chocolate Cake. I had a vague idea that this would be the cake I'd bake for our 25th anniversary. We were getting closer to this moment. After we'd been married for about 10 years, he made the same joke every year on our anniversary. 11 long years, he would say in an affectionate way. 12 long years. It made me feel safe when he joked like this, because surely no one would make that remark if they really thought the years were long. I told people how lucky we were and how we never argued. As symbols go, a heart-shaped cake tin bought for a wedding is not exactly subtle. It's Disney-fied romance, fashioned into a shiny object. I was only 19 when we met, and 23 when we married. He was 7 years older and was one of my college teachers, which didn't seem to matter at the time. One morning in June 2020, sitting on an ordinary park bench, drinking a cup of coffee, he said he didn't love me anymore. Not like that. He never elaborated what "like that" meant. It didn't seem real. I thought that divorce was something that happened to other people. My parents, for example, who split up when I was 14. At the time, this was the biggest shock of my life. One New Year's Day, my father announced over lunch that his resolution was not to live with our mother anymore. I was the one who had casually asked whether anyone had any resolutions. For years, I felt I had caused him to leave with my question. My purchase of the heart-shaped tin suggests that I was urgently searching for a happily ever after, a sweet and unbroken heart. Of all my ex-husband's excellent qualities, one of his greatest was, or so it seemed to me, that he was so steadfast. He never gave me a moment's doubt about his loyalty. The morning of the day he left, he brought me a cup of tea in bed, just as he always did, and I thanked him with real gratitude, just as I always did. When the tin clattered loudly to the ground, it echoed my own shock. Certain kitchen objects become loaded with meaning in a way that we are not fully in control of. You can't predict which will be the utensils you get attached to, the favorite mug, the spoon that feels just right in your hand, and which belongings decline over time into clutter. And then there are objects that, even if they were made in some anonymous factory and bought in some anonymous shop, seem to carry with them a kind of magic. There is the plate that makes everything you put on it taste better, or the bowl you keep but can't actually bear to use because it reminds you too strongly of the person who gave it to you. What should I do with the tin heart now that its original meaning was ruptured? When I told the story of it falling on the floor to friends, they all, without exception, made the same suggestion. I should invest the tin with new associations. I should bake a cake for myself in it, the richest cake imaginable, and throw myself a giant separation party. I was comforted by the kindness of the suggestion, but didn't feel quite ready for this yet. Instead, I left the tin where it was. I walked past it multiple times a day and sometimes winced slightly when I remembered it was there, a clanging metal symbol of rejection. To cheer myself up, or at least to stop feeling so sad, I started reading books about Buddhism. I read that our suffering was linked to our attachment to things. These books told me that the ground beneath our feet is never as permanent or solid as we might hope, and that the tighter we cling to our comforts, the more we hide the truth from ourselves that we can never really hold on to anything. One of the books, by an American Buddhist nun called Pema Chodron, said that abandon hope would be a good slogan to stick on your fridge. It says something about how low I was feeling that I found this a consoling message. All these years, I had been holding on to my marriage as the support that would keep me safe in a dark world. But perhaps it was better to stop searching for something or someone to save me. Sometimes you can't see what is right in front of you. However often I might have toyed with the idea of using the tin to make an anniversary cake, I had never actually done it. This metal heart became a piece of furniture my husband and I both rushed past each day on the way to work. Maybe the calm of our marriage, which I had taken such pride in, was little more than conflict avoidance or a sign that neither of us cared quite enough to voice our true feelings, including the negative ones. If the tin was a symbol of our love, why had we both neglected it to the point that it had become so rusty? Once something has ended, when you look back, all you can see are clues that it was always doomed. Tiny moments of dissatisfaction get inflated into portents. The past itself becomes contaminated. You forget all the good weeks and years, and your mind crowds with memories of the times when you felt lonely or resentful, or the moments when you could see that the other person was somehow unhappy, but you couldn't find the way or the words to reach out and help. I started to wonder whether the tin itself, and the cake I originally baked in it, was a powerful indication that it was doomed from the start. Maybe a man who was so fussy about cherries was not the man for me. But when I picked it up, trying to decide what to do with it, the tin felt as solid as it did 23 years ago, as if it were still waiting to be used. And that was Why Do We Hang On to Objects That Hurt Us by B. Wilson. Next we have, I'm a 62-year-old longevity doctor. These are the 7 things I do every day. These healthy habits are literally what the doctor ordered, and they're easy to pick up, we promise. By Jesse Van Amberg. Humankind has put men on the moon, explored the seas, and developed self-driving cars. But as of yet, there's no technology that will guarantee a person lives past 100. What decades of scientific research and innovation have taught us is the importance of extending our health span, or the number of years we live fit and disease-free. And the way to do that is to ward off chronic disease. Per the CDC, an estimated 93% of Americans over the age of 65 have at least one chronic disease, such as type 2 diabetes, cancer, or obesity. If we prevent the emergence of these illnesses, then we would extend the number of health years that a person has and preempt a shortened lifespan, says David Dodick, MD, a neurologist and the chief science and medical officer at Atria Health and Research Institute. That's the approach Dr. Dodick takes with his patients and with himself. And thankfully, maximizing your health span doesn't require fancy gadgets or expensive supplements. Seriously, skip the NAD plus strip. Instead, he urges all of us to nail the fundamentals of good health: sleep, fitness, diet, and stress management. It sounds simple, but research suggests that the more healthy habits you do, the longer your healthy life expectancy becomes. Not sure where to start? We talked to Dr. Dodick to hear exactly what he, as a longevity expert, does every single day to increase his odds of living a longer, healthier life. These habits are quite literally what the doctor ordered. Work out in some form. From 6:30 to 7:30 a.m., you can find Dr. Dodick at the gym, even on weekends. "The first thing I do in the morning is exercise," he says. "I'm a runner, so I do 25 to 30 minutes on a treadmill, stretch, and do some resistance training with weights on my legs and arms." If running isn't your jam, Dr. Dodick says that yoga, Pilates, walking, and swimming are all great options for getting your heart rate up and keeping yourself limber and active. But don't skimp on strength training, since preserving muscle mass and volume is vital for healthy aging. You start losing muscle mass and volume precipitously after the age of 50, he says. Sleep for 7 to 8 hours a night. Dr. Dodick aims for a minimum of 7 hours. "I try to go to bed and wake up at the same time, even on weekends," he adds. Sometimes late nights happen, but he tries to be as consistent as possible to support his immunity, metabolism, and heart health. When you sleep, you clear out proteins and toxins that accumulate that your brain needs to flush out, he adds. The result, he feels rested, clear-minded, and ready to take on the day. And in the long term, he's warding off serious conditions associated with lack of sleep, like diabetes, hypertension, depression, and heart disease. Eat for your mind. Dr. Dodick is a fan of the MIND diet, which is effectively a mashup of the Mediterranean diet, the gold standard for heart health, and the DASH diet, a specific nutritional intervention designed to combat hypertension. This eating plan is linked to reduced rates of cognitive decline and dementia, compared even to the Mediterranean and DASH diets. And brain health experts we spoke to earlier this year also recommend it. "I probably eat fish about 5 days a week," Dr. Dodick says. He also eats legumes, vegetables, fruit, particularly berries, nuts like walnuts, and whole grains. With the fish, you get brain-boosting omega-3s and healthy protein. The legumes, fruits, nuts, and vegetables provide vitamins, minerals, cancer-fighting antioxidants, and gut-protecting fiber. "I put olive oil on almost everything," he adds, citing studies demonstrating its potential to combat tau protein buildup in the brain, which is linked to Alzheimer's disease. Skip the processed stuff. You won't catch Dr. Dodick at the drive-thru anytime soon. "I don't eat ultra-processed foods, fast food, or processed red meats," he says. While there's no universally accepted definition of ultra-processed, He says that label applies to foods containing modified starches, emulsifiers, and sweeteners. It makes sense. Research has consistently linked diets high in ultra-processed food with dozens of chronic health conditions, as well as an estimated 10% increased risk of death. Walk this way. Dr. Dodick is a big proponent of walking to protect your health span, to the point where he uses a treadmill desk to avoid sitting all day when in the office. If you did brisk walking for 450 minutes a week, you buy yourself 4.5 years of extra life, Dr. Dodick says, citing data from an older 2012 study published in PLOS Medicine. That translates to a little over an hour of walking every day, which might seem like a lot, but the same study found that doing even a fraction of that, 75 minutes of brisk walking a week, is associated with an extra 1.8 years of life expectancy compared to not being active. Close the kitchen after 8 p.m. While he doesn't intentionally do intermittent fasting, Dr. Dodick stops eating after 8 p.m. This helps him naturally limit food intake and is also linked in some studies to longer lifespan, since late-night noshing may increase your risk of diabetes and obesity. Take a breath. Unfortunately, stress is unavoidable, Dr. Dodick says. Learning how to manage and adapt to it is crucial, given how profoundly chronic stress impacts your body over time. A study from 2021 found chronic stress may even make your cells age faster. I'm really intentional about it, he says. I take time out of every day to relax. Sometimes that looks like box breathing, inhaling slowly and deeply for 4 counts, holding that breath for 4, exhaling for 4, and then pausing for 4 counts before repeating the sequence. Sometimes that's going for a morning walk with coffee and taking a moment to appreciate the scenery. I try to do that in periods every day. And that was, I'm a 62-year-old longevity doctor. These are the 7 things I do every day by Jesse Van Amberg. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. Please join us next time. I'm Kathy Bostrom, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Think of all the strength you have in you, and the blood you carry within you.